Hello, and welcome to Musings on History. Episode 8.2, The Souls of Black Folk. Hello, and welcome back to Musings on History. This episode is the second in an ongoing series on the life and work of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Last episode covered his early life in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, undergraduate work at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, return to Massachusetts to attend Harvard University, the time spent abroad studying in Berlin, Germany, and his groundbreaking sociological study, The Philadelphia Negro, published in 1899. This episode is named after one of his most famous works, The Souls of Black Folk, published in 1903 during one of the busiest time periods of his life. Chapter 1, The Talented and the Submerged, a quick glance at late Victorian social attitudes. In July 1897, while still compiling the findings from his research in Philadelphia, Dr. Du Bois left Philadelphia and took a job as a professor of history and economics at Atlanta University, which is now known as Clark Atlanta University, an HBCU located in, where else? Atlanta, Georgia. While writing The Philadelphia Negro, Dr. Du Bois coined the term the submerged tenth to describe the black underclass in America. In historical materialist examinations of history, there's a concept of internal class divisions within populations. While some white Americans are wealthy, not all white Americans are, and this is an example of an internal class division. The submerged tenth was not indicative of all black Americans of this time period, nor was it indicative of all formerly slave black Americans, many of whom were able to attain wealth in the form of land and livestock in the Reconstruction era. The submerged tenth was an internal group within blackness that were located both in the North and South and who had varying degrees of literacy, but they were the poorest within the black race. Last episode, I talked about how Dr. Du Bois in his Philadelphia Negro study concluded that the submerged tenth were most negatively impacted by racism and discrimination, which is what led to them being the submerged tenth. But that they were overrepresented in depictions and characterizations of Negro life in America, and this was usually done by white missionaries and politicians. Dr. Du Bois had a pretty low opinion of the submerged tenth, and he called them lazy and unreliable, and he considered their overrepresentation to be the biggest obstacle in changing perceptions of black people in America. While Dr. Du Bois would not be considered an assimilationist like Frederick Douglass or Booker T. Washington, some of his ideas around this time did tiptoe around the margins of assimilationist ideology. Assimilationists believed that Black Americans needed to prove that they were as invested in the American project as white Americans, which some Black intellectuals felt was very critical during this time of increased immigration from Europe. At this time, Dr. Du Bois believed that elites, both black and white, were critical for continued achievements in America. Where he differed from the assimilationists was in his desire for black Americans to retain their historical and cultural links to Africa so that generations of black children would not conceptualize their origins beginning with slavery. Later in 1903, he popularized the term the talented tenth, which applied to the wealthiest and most educated black Americans. The phrase originated among white northern liberals in the American Baptist Home Mission Society, which was a Christian missionary society supported by John D. Rockefeller. The goal of this society was to establish black colleges in the South to train black teachers and elites. In 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote an essay titled The Talented Tenth during the American Industrial Revolution. Dr. Du Bois thought that the time was ripe for African Americans to advance in society. The Talented Tenth refers to the 1 in 10 black men that have cultivated the ability to become leaders of the black community through acquiring a college education, writing books and giving speeches, and becoming directly involved in social activism. In The Talented 10th Essay, Dr. Du Bois argued that college-educated African-American men should sacrifice their personal interests, such as fame or profit-seeking, and instead use their education and connections to lead and better the Black community. Chapter 2, What's Beef? The Tuskegee Model and the Atlanta Compromise. Now, as I mentioned in the last episode, Dr. Du Bois was a founding member of the American Negro Academy, an organization that encouraged and supported Black American study of the liberal arts. He saw classical education as the pathway to bettering the Black community and as the basis for what would eventually be known as public intellectuals. In The Talented 10th, he says, "Men we shall have only as we make manhood the object of the work of schools, intelligence, broad sympathy, knowledge of the world that was and is, and of the relation of men to it. This is the curriculum of that higher education which must underlie true life. On this foundation, we may build breadwinning, the skill of hand and quickness of brain, with never a fear lest the child and man mistake the means of living for the object of life." He also writes, "The Negro race, like all races, is going to be saved by its exceptional men. The problem of education, then, among Negroes must first of all deal with the talented 10th. It is the problem of developing the best of this race that they may guide the mass away from the contamination and death of the worst." Which, ouch. Bear in mind, though, that this was more an expression of what were then widely held late Victorian attitudes about class mobility rather than an expression of internalized anti-Blackness. Around the globe, as the growth of capitalism and industrialization transformed societies, the new influx of wealth upended the previous social orders and the concept of the new man was born. So you had like men like Andrew Carnegie, who was born poor in Scotland and then became one of the world's wealthiest men. Men like him symbolized the limitless potential of a man with a sound education and a plan. But the problem is Andrew Carnegie and other captains of industry like Rockefeller and Mellon and all those others, they were only able to achieve their dreams by crushing workers' dreams. And violently so, sometimes. Laborers who tried to organize strikes and unions so that they could better their working conditions and their lives were violently suppressed, while Carnegie, Rockefeller, Mellon, and others donated large sums of money to support the building of libraries, colleges, and other public buildings, all bearing their names, as a way of giving back to the community. However, only a small percentage of the community ever really got to enjoy these gifts, since while the talented 10th attained college educations, the other 90% of Black America, and indeed America in general, were told to toil for low pay and harsh working conditions and never try to improve their social or economic situation. In 1895, the Cotton States An International Exposition was held at Piedmont Park in Atlanta, Georgia. The exposition was designed to promote the American South to the world and showcase products and new technologies, as well as to encourage trade with Latin America. The Cotton States An International Exposition featured exhibits from several states, including various innovations in agriculture and technology, and over 800,000 people attended. On 18 September 1895, Booker T. Washington, who was by this time president of the Tuskegee Institute, gave a speech at the Cotton States Exposition that has come to be known as the Atlanta Compromise. In the speech, Washington promoted vocational education and industrial occupations and the learning of other practical trades for Black Americans versus more intellectual pursuits such as higher classical education. He felt that this was the best path towards economic advancement and wealth creation for most Black people, especially in the South. The trade-off that he proposed was that Black people would submit to Jim Crow discrimination, segregation, disenfranchisement, and non-unionized employment, and that Southern whites would permit Black people to receive a basic education, some economic opportunities in certain areas, and justice within the legal system, and that Northern whites would invest in Southern enterprises and fund Black educational charities. So after Reconstruction, the Southern whites needed to revitalize the economy. I mean, it was agrarian and slave-based, and now they had to pay people, and, you know, the Brits and the French and everybody else had other places where they could get cotton, like Turkey, Egypt, India. So the South needed to, like, rebrand, I guess. And this was Booker T. Washington's pitch to include Black Americans in this rebrand. In this vein, the Atlanta Compromise reminds me of the compromises that the bourgeois made in the German Empire with the Junker class in the 1840s and 1850s. The Junker class is the aristocratic class of the German Empire. So this is Second Reich. In the view of Karl Marx and many other German historiographers, the bourgeois, who had belatedly joined the Mars Revolution of 1848 on the side of the working class and the peasants, they had betrayed the working class, who were agitating for greater political and economic rights, when they made a bargain with the ruling classes that saw them become neutered politically in exchange for greater economic liberties, but only for their class, who were the capitalists that owned the factories. The working class and ethnic and religious minorities within the empire, such as Poles and Jews, received nothing. What this did was create a German empire that was politically conservative, hawkish, and had very few civil liberties, but it was industrious and growing wealthier, which eventually brought them into conflict with the other European great powers as they jockeyed for dominance over the Earth's resources. Dr. Du Bois was initially supportive of the Atlanta Compromise, and he wrote to Booker T. Washington saying, "Let me heartily congratulate you upon your phenomenal success at Atlanta. It was a word fitly spoken." But he soon changed his view on the Atlanta Compromise, especially after the lynching of Sam Hose, which occurred near Atlanta in 1899. Hose, who was an exceptionally bright man who was born in 1875 in Macon County, Georgia, had initially planned to continue his studies, but after taking in his invalid mother, he moved to Coweta County, Georgia, and worked as a manual laborer. On 12 April 1899, he was accused of murdering his employer, Alfred Cranford, after a heated argument when Hose had requested time off to visit his mother, who was ill. Alfred Cranford threatened to kill Hose and pointed a revolver at him. And so Hose was working at the time with an axe in his hands, and due to this threat, he defended himself by throwing the axe, killing Cranford. Hose then fled the scene, and the search for him began shortly thereafter. The police did not investigate the crime scene, didn't gather evidence, or interview Cranford's wife, who witnessed the entire thing. Over the next few days, furor amongst the white population in the county was stoked by rumors that suggested that Hose had sexually assaulted Cranford's wife, Mattie Cranford, and assaulted his infant child. Newspapers portrayed Hose as a monster in human form who gleefully raped Mrs. Cranford and their infant child in front of the dying Mr. Cranford, and for good measure claimed without evidence that Hose was suffering from advanced syphilis. The police detectives investigating the crime interviewed Mrs. Cranford, who stated that after killing her husband, Hose had fled the scene and had never entered her house. She also denied that she was raped and stated that no harm had come to her child either. On 23 April 1899, Hose was apprehended in Marshallville, Georgia, and returned by train to Coweta County. A mob removed Hose from the train at gunpoint in Noonan, Georgia, where his captives eventually agreed to release Hose to the sheriff's custody if they were given reward money for his capture, although they didn't actually capture him. As Hose was being led to his cell, a member of the mob put a pistol to the sheriff's head and they took Hose away to Troutman Field. Now, what happened after this is too gruesome to go into too much detail, so I'm just going to spare us all the nightmares and say that Hose was dismembered, then burned alive, and then lynched after his death. So it's referred to as the Sam Hose lynching, but he underwent hours of agonizing torture and was dead by the time he was actually lynched. The crowd at his lynching was estimated to be about 2,000 people strong, and several of Mr. Hose's body parts were removed, and internal organs as well, and they were sold as souvenirs. His remains were never recovered and might be part of some Georgia collector's prized possessions to this day. And that was not uncommon, actually, in researching this episode and the lynching of Sam Hose and lynchings in general. I came to learn that there was a pretty robust trade in the internal organs and external organs of Black people who got lynched. And that in the 1980s, this man was cleaning out his dad's house and found out that not only was his father in the Klan, which personally, I don't believe that that man didn't know his dad was in the Klan, but he found his dad's souvenirs and he had them like carefully labeled so you knew whose remains it was, when the lynching took place, and why the lynching took place. And he made this big show of like giving these people's relatives back their remains. And that is just the most disgusting thing that I think I've ever heard of. The lynching of Sam Hose was the most violent display of Southern white racism that Dr. Du Bois had yet encountered. And seeing as how it was only 1899, like we haven't even gotten to, you know, Tulsa and Rosewood and all that stuff, he hadn't seen anything yet. He resolved that one could not be a calm, cool, and detached scientist while Negroes were lynched, murdered, and starved. Dr. Du Bois realized that the cure wasn't simply telling people the truth, it was inducing them to act on the truth. This incident served as irrefutable proof to Dr. Du Bois that white Southerners could not be trusted to hold up their end of the Atlanta Compromise, which mostly involved them controlling politics locally and at the state level and making sure that Black people got a fair trial and not what happened to Mr. Hose. And even that was asking too much, seems like. He insisted that Black people in America and globally should continue to agitate for equal rights and to pursue all forms of higher education, just as their white counterparts did. The lynching of Sam Hose notwithstanding, Booker T. Washington, who was one of the most preeminent Black men of his day, still had a very large and vocal following who agreed with the tenets of the Atlanta Compromise and the Tuskegee Model. African Americans in Booker T. Washington's camp included Frederick Douglass, while the whites in his camp included Andrew Carnegie, William Howard Taft, Robert Curtis Ogden, George Eastman, Julius Rosenwald, and Henry Huddleston Rogers. To the surprise of no one, the plan that gave white people all the political power and still let them retain the bulk of the economic power in America had the most support amongst white industrialists. In Dr. Du Bois' camp, you had men like Archibald H. Grimke, an African-American lawyer, intellectual, journalist, diplomat, and community leader who was born a slave in Charleston, South Carolina. Kelly Miller, an African-American mathematician, sociologist, essayist, newspaper columnist, and author who was the first African-American to study graduate-level mathematics in the United States at Johns Hopkins. James Weldon Johnson, an African-American writer and civil rights activist, and Paul Lawrence Dunbar, an African-American poet, novelist, and short story writer. These men represented the talented tenth of Black America, and so they were thus compelled to fight for equal rights that would help them achieve their fullest potential, and other Black people help them achieve their potential as well. In 1896, Dr. Du Bois had organized the inaugural Atlanta Conference of Negro Problems. It ran annually from 1896 to 1914 and was invite only and mail only. Now, the first two Atlanta University conferences of Negro problems were held by George C. Bradford in 1896 and 1897. But although he co-founded the Atlanta University Studies and directed these first two conferences, Bradford's contributions to these events are often omitted, and W.E.B. Du Bois is usually solely credited with founding this conference. The first Conference of Negro Problems at Atlanta University focused on the morality of African Americans in cities. This was Bradford's idea. Bradford invited the Department of Labor to help him carry out the study and to tabulate and publish the results. The statistics they collected became the basis of a serious dealing with the social and economic conditions of African Americans. The campus was located near the Grand Contraband Camp, an area of refuge. Bradford based his study on the Tuskegee model, which was based on the Hampton model. So Hampton University was located near the Grand Contraband Camp. Now I'm here. And the Grand Contraband Camp was an area of refuge for escaped slaves who the Union forces had refused to return to their Confederate masters by defining them as contraband of war. The Grand Contraband Camp later became the first self-contained Black community in the United States and occupied the area, again, that now comprises the downtown section of present-day Independence City of Hampton, Virginia. So the American Missionary Society, which was mostly made up of Congregational and Presbyterian ministers, they hired a woman of color named Mary S. Peak, who was an educator and humanitarian who was part of the Black elite of the Hampton Roads area, to teach the freedmen in the Grand Contraband Camp and instruct them on how to operate in what they deemed polite society. Mary S. Peak was born free in Norfolk, Virginia, to an English father who was the second son of a baronet and a mulatto mother who was also born free. She had been educated back in Alexandria, Virginia, back when it was still part of D.C., and so she was well connected with the Black and mixed race elites all along the Eastern Seaboard and their various white wealthy benefactors. When the U.S. Congress enacted a law in 1840 that prohibited free people of color in the district from being educated, Mary returned to the Hampton Roads area and secretly taught slaves to read at great personal risk to herself. Now, although Mary S. Peak was Hampton Institute's first teacher, the former Union General Samuel Chapman Armstrong was hired by the AMA to lead the institution, and he believed that training freedmen in agriculture and industry would give them the skills they needed for the economic advancement of the South. Now, that's an important note there. The Hampton model was not so much geared towards helping former slaves achieve economic parity or autonomy, but rather helping the South, meaning the white people of the South, economically recover from the ravages of the Civil War. Armstrong was the third son of a Christian missionary named Richard Armstrong, and he was born in Wailuku, Maui, Kingdom of Hawaii, in 1839. Although he considered himself a Hawaiian, because Hawaii had not yet been illegally annexed by the United States at this time, Armstrong chose to join the Union Army as he was an abolitionist. After the Civil War, Armstrong joined the Freedmen's Bureau, and he meant for the Hampton Institute to be a place where Black students could receive post-secondary education to become teachers, as well as receive vocational training while paying for their education through manual labor. This was how his father had run their missionary schools in Hawaii. Now, can you imagine some white man coming to your kingdom and asking you to set up a church and a school, and you nicely allow him to do so? And then he tells your citizens that go to his church in his school that they are, one, not intelligent enough to study the liberal and classical arts, and that, two, in order to pay for the education that he decided was most useful to your people, you, as a native Hawaiian, need to pay him, a settler and a guest, for the privilege, and I'm using that word very loosely here, the privilege of being patronized, and you have to pay for it through manual labor. I would have told him to kiss my ass, and I would have burnt his church, and I would have threw him into the sea. The predominant theme of history since 1492 seems to be white people going to other people's lands uninvited and unannounced, spreading disease and a patronizing form of Christianity that no one asked for, and then demanding to be treated like saviors and wanting to be paid for basically ruining everybody's lives. Armstrong also believed that freedmen did not have the cultural and moral qualities necessary to take part in politics and that they should not vote. And this philosophy made Armstrong's educational program more acceptable to white people in the South. Thus, the Hampton model was primarily focused on instilling a moral core in Black Americans, a moral core that did not question the supremacy of whiteness and a moral core that accepted its status as laborers. Hampton Institute's most famous alumnus was Booker T. Washington, who was later hired to implement a version of the Hampton model in Tuskegee, Alabama, at the Tuskegee Institute, which then became the Tuskegee model. Washington collaborated with the philanthropist Julian Rosenwald in the early 20th century to create a model for rural Black schools, and Rosenwald established a fund that matched monies raised by communities to build more than 5,000 schools for rural Black children, mostly in the South. In 1896, Washington's colleague and former classmate Charles W. Green recruited George Washington Carver to work in the Tuskegee Agricultural Department, and Carver's work was so prodigious that in 1900, Booker T. Washington asked Carver to set up a business expo of sorts that demonstrated the business capability of Black Americans at Tuskegee. Washington and Carver also established a self-sufficiency project near the campus of Tuskegee. This project, which was entirely Black-owned, comprised 4,000 lots of real estate and was formally established and designated Greenwood in 1901. To serve as a model for Black-owned business and residential districts in every city in the nation that had a significant Black population. After Booker T. Washington visited Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1905 and addressed a large gathering there, Black Oklahomans followed the Tuskegee model and named Tulsa's Black-owned and operated district Greenwood in 1906. Dr. Du Bois, who some at Atlanta University felt was not religious enough to work there, criticized both the focus of Bradford's study and his methodology, which he felt was an effort by Bradford to replicate the Hampton and Tuskegee models, because it was. Thus, Dr. Du Bois took over the conference and was determined to execute a program of scientific inquiry into social, economic, and political conditions of African Americans at Atlanta University, which he had previously been unable to convince white institutions to try and do. This is similar to what he did with the Philadelphia Negro, except it was going to be focused on what he later coined the term as the Black Belt in the South. Dr. Du Bois felt that the Hampton and Tuskegee models overemphasized an obsequious form of morality as a means of achieving economic stability, but it failed to address racial discrimination and violence as the chief reasons for Black poverty. During Dr. Du Bois' leadership, the studies of the conference shifted their focus and led to an increase in state and national funding for African American high schools, which resulted from a 1901 study led by Dr. Du Bois. This study uncovered that the money allocated to maintaining and running Black schools was less than the money allocated to similar white schools. For instance, Delaware in 1896 gave $1.66 per capita for white students and 81 cents for the Black students. It also uncovered that twice as many African American communities provided most, if not all, the funds for their schools versus white American communities. There was even an unequal distribution of money for salaries, and white teachers earned significantly more than Black teachers at the time. Although there was an initial increase in funding, a decade later, Dr. Du Bois reinvestigated high school education amidst African Americans and found that little change had actually occurred. For example, in 1911, Houston County, Georgia, educated about 3,200 Black people and about 1,050 white people, but funding for Black schools was about $4,500 for the year compared to $10,700 for white schools. During this time, Georgia's funding of public schools was based on a variety of state and local reactions to different laws and court rulings like Plessy versus Ferguson, which established legal racial segregation in America and made separate but equal public schools for African Americans and white students. Though the school systems were supposed to be equal, in practice, they were separate and unequal, and Black teachers still earned considerably less than white teachers. Chapter 3, The First Pan-African Conference of 1900. Unlike the assimilationists, Dr. Du Bois was interested in Pan-Africanism, which is a global movement that aims to encourage and strengthen bonds of solidarity between all indigenous and diaspora ethnic groups of African descent. Pan-Africanism originates in the struggles of the African people against enslavement and colonization, recognizing that while our struggles may not be the same, they are similar, and so is our oppressor, and that we not only have a shared history, but a shared destiny as well. The central belief is that unity is vital to economic, social, and political progress, and Pan-Africanism aims to unify and uplift people of African descent. The first Pan-African Conference was held in London from 23 to 25 July 1900, slightly ahead of the Paris exhibition of 1900, so that the attendees could attend both conferences. The Pan-African Conference was organized by Henry Sylvester Williams, a Trinidadian barrister, and took place in Westminster Town Hall. There were 37 delegates and 10 observers from all over Africa, the West Indies, the United States, and the United Kingdom. Men like Samuel Coleridge Taylor, John Alcindor, Dada Habai, probably got that wrong, Nairoji, John Archer, Henry Francis Downing, and Bishop Alexander Walters, who was the conference chair, gathered to discuss the leading issues of the African diaspora. Dr. Du Bois presented a letter that he drafted to send to European leaders called the Address to the Nations of the World, urging them to support the struggle against racism and to give their African and Caribbean colonies home rule. Bishop Alexander Walters, in his opening address, The Trials and Tribulations of the Colored Race in America, noted that, for the first time in history, Black people had gathered from all parts of the globe to discuss and improve the condition of their race, to assert their rights and organize so that they might take an equal place among nations. The Bishop of London, Mandell Creighton, gave a speech of welcome referring to the benefits of self-government which Britain must confer on other races as soon as possible. Unlike his fellow assimilationists, Booker T. Washington was not against Pan-Africanism. In fact, in 1899, he wrote this to several Black newspapers in the United States after returning from a trip abroad in the UK. Booker T. Washington, who had been traveling in the UK in the summer of 1899, wrote, "In connection with the assembling of so many Negroes in London from different parts of the world, a very important movement has just been put upon foot. It is known as the Pan-African Conference. Representatives from Africa, the West Indian Islands, and other parts of the world asked me to meet them a few days ago with a view to making a preliminary program for this conference, and we had a most interesting meeting. It is surprising to see the strong intellectual mold which many of these Africans and West Indians possess. The object and character of the Pan-African Conference is best told in the words of the resolution, which was adopted at the meeting referred to, viz., in view of the widespread ignorance which is prevalent in England about the treatment of native races under European and American rule, the African Association, which consists of members of the race resident in England and which has been in existence for nearly 2 years, have resolved during the Paris Exposition of 1900, which many representatives of the race may be visiting, to hold a conference in London in the month of May of the said year in order to take steps to influence public opinion on existing proceedings and conditions affecting the welfare of the natives in various parts of Africa, the West Indies, and the United States. The resolution is signed by Mr. H. Mason Joseph, President, and Mr. H. Sylvester Williams as Honorable Secretary. The Honorable Secretary will be pleased to hear from representative natives who are desirous of attending at an early date. He may be addressed Common Room Grays in London, WC. I don't know what WC means. Booker T. Washington was unable to attend the first Pan-African Conference, but he was invited to help design a preliminary program along with Dr. Du Bois. The two men actually had a very cordial relationship as they both represented the HBCUs that they were affiliated with, and their views weren't too far off from one another. This is in stark contrast to, say, Dr. Du Bois' relationship with Marcus Garvey, for instance, or even Ida B. Wells, who he respected but still didn't consider as an equal because she was a woman. But as I will address soon, regardless of how Dr. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington felt about each other personally and professionally, some of their acolytes did not share their desire for gentlemanly disagreement and created a beef that's now attributed to the two men themselves, which in reality did not exist. But while the two of them weren't beefing, I mean, based on like what other people, their contemporaries, had to say about their personalities, it was kind of a frenemy situation. Like W.E.B. Du Bois was always being asked, because Booker T. Washington was more popular than he was, for various reasons, for a little bit of a longer time, and especially in the early 20th century. And so people were always asking him, like, well, what do you think? Because they were trying to get a rise out of him. And he would always be like super cordial. And he always had to be like the first person to congratulate him if he got a grant or made a speech or went abroad or whatever. But the tone of it, and then how he like would 5 seconds later turn around and be like, although I don't agree with anything you said it so well. Yeah, it was definitely like some frenemies type stuff. It's kind of funny when you think about it. Men are very petty. Over the course of the 3-day conference, many papers were delivered. Among them were Conditions Favoring a High Standard of African Humanity, which was written by C.W. French of St. Kitts. The Preservation of Racial Equality, written by Anna H. Jones from Kansas City, Missouri. The Necessary Concord to be Established Between Native Races and European Colonists, written by Benito Sylvain, who was the Haitian aide-de-camp to the Ethiopian emperor, who was, what was that guy's name? Oh, I'm not even going to try and remember who the emperor was at that time. The Negro Problem in America, which was written by Anna J. Cooper from Washington, D.C. The Progress of Our People, written by John E. Quinlan of St. Lucia, and Africa, the Sphinx of History, and The Light of Unsolved Problems, written by D.E. Tobias, also from the United States. A wide range of issues from across the diaspora were discussed, among them Richard Phipps' complaint of discrimination against Black people in the Trinidadian Civil Service, and an attack by William Meyer, a medical student at Edinburgh University, on the pseudoscientific racism and eugenics movement. Discussions followed the presentation of the papers, and on the last day, George James Christian, a law student from Dominica, led a discussion on the subject, Organized Plunder and Human Progress Have Made Our Race Their Battlefield, saying that in the past, Africans had been kidnapped from their land, and in South Africa and Rhodesia, slavery was being revived in the form of forced labor. The conference culminated in the conversion of the African Association, which had been formed by Sylvester Williams in 1897, into the Pan-African Association, and the implementation of Dr. Du Bois' unanimously adopted address to the nations of the world, which was then sent to various heads of state where people of African descent were living and suffering from oppression through colonial practices. The address implored the United States and the imperial European nations to acknowledge and protect the rights of people of African descent, and to respect the integrity and independence of the free Negro states of Abyssinia, Liberia, Haiti, etc. Signed by Walters, president of the Pan-African Association, the Canadian Reverend Henry B. Brown, vice president, H. Sylvester Williams, General Secretary, and Dr. Du Bois, Chairman of the Committee on the Address, the document contained the phrase, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line," which Dr. Du Bois would use 3 years later in the forethought of his book, The Souls of Black Folk. As for James Christian's paper on the status of Black people in British-controlled Rhodesia, which is now the independent southern African country of Zimbabwe, in September 1900, the delegates of the Pan-African Congress petitioned Queen Victoria through the British government to look into the treatment of Africans in South Africa and Rhodesia, including specified acts of injustice perpetuated by whites there, which were namely, one, the degrading and illegal compound system of labor in Kimberley and in Rhodesia, where most of the world's diamonds were then mined. Two, the so-called indenture, i.e. legalized bondage of African men and women and children to white colonists. Three, the system of compulsory labor in public works. Four, the pass or docket system used for people of color. Five, local bylaws tending to segregate and degrade Africans, such as the curfew, the denial to Africans of the use of footpaths and the use of separate public conveyances. Six, difficulties in acquiring real property, and seven, difficulties in obtaining the franchise. The response eventually received by Sylvester Williams on 17 January 1901 stated, "Sir, I am directed by Mr. Secretary Chamberlain to state that he has received the Queen's commands to inform you that the memorial of the Pan-African Conference requesting the situation of the native races in South Africa has been laid before Her Majesty, and that she was graciously pleased to command him to return an answer to it on behalf of her government. Mr. Chamberlain accordingly desires to assure the members of the Pan-African Conference that by settling the lines on which the administration of the conquered territories is to be conducted, Her Majesty's government will not overlook the interests and welfare of the native races. A few days later, Queen Victoria responded more personally via her private secretary, Arthur Bigg, and instructed him to write to Williams and the committee, which he did on 21 January 1901, the day before the Queen died. Although the specific injustices in South Africa and Rhodesia continued on well into the 20th century, the conference brought them to the attention of the entire world. Chapter 4, The Souls of Black Folk. In 1901, Dr. Du Bois wrote a critical review of Booker T. Washington's autobiography, Up From Slavery. He later expanded on this critique in an essay which is now included in his book, The Souls of Black Folk, Essays and Sketches, published in 1903. The book contains several essays on race, some of which had been published earlier in the Atlantic Monthly. Dr. Du Bois drew from his own experiences as an African-American in American society for most of the essays. In addition to its notable relevance in African-American history, The Souls of Black Folk also holds an important place in social science as one of the early works in the field of sociology. The Souls of Black Folk contains Dr. Du Bois' earliest use of the term double consciousness, which some have theorized he adapted from Ralph Waldo Emerson's works, The Transcendentalist and Fate. I cannot say his name. Ralph Waldo, you know that. You know who it is. The Walden Pond guy. Or is that somebody else? It doesn't matter. He applies Emerson's idea of double consciousness to Black American existence, where Black people must have two fields of vision at all times. They must be conscious of how they view themselves, as well as being conscious of how the world views them, and then attempt to reconcile these often wildly disparate perceptions of oneself while navigating a white supremacist society. Each chapter in The Souls of Black Folk begins with a pair of epigraphs. There's the text from a poem, usually by a European poet, and the musical score of a spiritual, which Dr. Du Bois describes in his foreword, called The Forethought, as some echo of haunting melody from the only American music which welled up from Black souls in the dark past. Dr. Brent Edward Hayes, a Columbia University English and comparative literature professor, writes that Dr. Du Bois chose to juxtapose the text of the European written poems with the musical scores of Negro spirituals to suggest that Black life and culture, which Dr. Du Bois describes as life within the veil, will always be inaccessible to white people. Of this veil, Dr. Du Bois writes in The Forethought, "Leaving, then, the world of the white man, I have stepped within the veil, raising it that you may view faintly its deeper recesses, the meaning of its religion, the passion of its human sorrow, and the struggle of its greater souls." He concludes with the words, "Need I add that I who speak here am bone of the bone and flesh of the flesh of them that live within the veil?" In chapter 1 of Souls of Black Folk, which is titled Of Our Spiritual Strivings, Dr. Du Bois lays out an overview of his thesis, which is that African Americans need the right to vote, the right to a good education, and equality and justice under the law. He says that these things will cement Black American humanity and ease the burden of double consciousness. Now, personally, I'm not sure if recognition of my humanity enshrines my humanity. If anything, I think having your humanity validated by another person that is unlike you, in particular, it kind of makes your status even more precarious. But I admit to not being very into like the metaphysical. So please defer to the guy with the PhD in sociology from Harvard. Don't listen to me. So another thing that I noticed when rereading The Souls of Black Folk, and I can say now that like the way that I was taught to read this book was abysmal. Like none of the things that I've noticed or that I read in reviews of The Souls of Black Folk, like they didn't point out any of this shit. I didn't know what the hell the book was about. And I'm going to be honest with you. I lied about reading it It was kind of a dry read. And the reason why was because I didn't really know what he was getting at. But when I was rereading it, I was like, oh, this is actually interesting. But one of the things that I noticed was that Dr. Du Bois uses language in two senses in this book. There's language in the mainstream white sense, and then there's the Black interpretation, which encompasses both an understanding of the white sense in use of the word, and then there's another interpretation that white people cannot grasp. And an example of this is the veil. According to Dr. Du Bois, this veil is worn by all African Americans because their view of the world and its potential economic, political, and social opportunities are so vastly different from those of white people. The veil is a visual manifestation of the color line. Thus, this veil is the white interpretation of it. The veil for white people is the line that keeps black people in their assigned places and leaves white people free to dominate whatever space they want. But then Dr. Du Bois sublimates the function of the veil when he refers to it as a gift of second sight for African Americans, thus simultaneously characterizing the veil as both a blessing and a curse. Second sight is a phenomenon that's referenced and believed in many non-European cultures in America, and maybe amongst Europeans, but we're not talking about them. We're talking about white people. White Americans have largely distillated or done away with their ethnic heritage and ethnic identification for a larger white identification. There's a whole lot of talk about when this group of people became white, when that group of people became white. And it was when they no longer like carried most of their ethnic and cultural monikers on them. They might still look it, but they don't like embody it because they're just white now. So yeah, second sight amongst black people in America and in the Caribbean in particular, it's when a person has visions of future events, usually through their dreams. And so a way to know if a person is going to have the second sight is if they're born with a call on their face. And the call is it's when you're born with like a piece or the whole amniotic sac over your face, a literal veil, right? So there's the veil as we understand white people to understand it. And then there's the veil with us. Like if you tell just a white person like, oh yeah, my grandma was born with a call on her face. And my grandma was actually born with a call on her face. And she used to talk to dead people like on a pretty regular basis, like just regular conversations with dead people. And she did not care who was watching. It was real interesting stuff. It was embarrassing when I was a kid, but I mean, I wish I had appreciated it. But like you go to a black person, especially one that's from the deep south, and you'd be like, yeah, my granny was born with the veil. And they'll probably know what you're talking about. Maybe. I don't know. These younger generations don't really know anything despite being born with the internet. But in generations past, you could do that. You could just go up to any black person and be like, yeah, my granny was born with a veil. And they'd be like, oh, cool. I got a cousin who was born with a veil. Maybe they're telling the truth. Maybe they're not. But you know what, that they know what you mean, right? But then when we talk about like, man, they live in a totally different world. Like there's just certain things that only white people think or only white people are going to get away with. They understand that too. And white people understand it too. They'll act like they don't. They're always like, oh my God, I didn't know it was like that for you guys. Yeah, you knew. You just thanked your lucky stars that you were born white in America and kept it moving. So that's one of the things that I noticed in this chapter. And throughout the whole book that he did, he uses language both ways. So I guess you could call it code switching, but I wouldn't do that because code switching is corny. The second chapter of The Dawn of Freedom covers the Reconstruction era, which lasted from 1861 to 1872. And the importance of the Freedmen's Bureau. This is also where Dr. Du Bois reintroduces the problem of the color line. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. The relation of the darker to the lighter races of men in Asia and Africa and America and the islands of the sea. Dr. Du Bois describes the Freedmen's Bureau as one of the most singular and interesting of the attempts made by a great nation to grapple with vast problems of race and social condition. He says that the Bureau was one of the great landmarks of political and social progress. After a year's work, Dr. Du Bois states that it relieved a vast amount of physical suffering. It transported 7,000 fugitives from congested centers back to the farm. And best of all, it inaugurated the crusade of the New England schoolmarm. Bear in mind that Dr. Du Bois' view of the Freedmen's Bureau was colored by the fact that he was also educated by New England schoolmarms and that he was close personal friends with many of the wealthy white philanthropists who funded the Bureau long after the U.S. government lost interest in it. He goes on to give the Freedmen's Bureau credit for the creation of Fisk University, his alma mater, Atlanta University, his employer, Howard University, the alma mater and employer of many of his friends, and Hampton University, the alma mater of his sometime friend, Booker T. Washington. And he acknowledges the men he calls the apostles of human culture, Edmund Asa Ware, Samuel C. Armstrong, and Erastus Cravath. Essentially, this chapter is a donations pitch for the then dying Freedmen's Bureau and many of the organizations that it supported. White Americans were starting to lose interest in the plight of the emancipated Negro, and one of the results was that the Freedmen's Savings Bank, a government-backed bank where many freedmen had deposited their life savings, had failed. He worried that the demise of the Freedmen's Savings Bank would result in freedmen losing all faith in savings. In this chapter, he also continues to advocate for Black political inclusion, especially in the South. He argues that if we cannot peacefully reconstruct the South with white votes, we certainly can with Black votes. He also says, the granting of the ballot to the Black man was a necessity, the very least a guilty nation could grant a wronged race, and the only method of compelling the South to accept the results of the war. Thus, Negro suffrage ended a civil war by beginning a race feud. And so in that, he's alluding to the white suffragettes like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and them other ladies with the white pantsuits or whatever, who took umbrage at the fact that the Black man got the vote before women did. And so it was the opinion of a lot of preeminent Black men of this era, W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, and some other men that they didn't think it was their place to hinder white women from voting. And W.E.B. Du Bois was like all in for women's suffrage. But they said that, like, you guys just want to vote so that you can like vote like white men, like, this whole thing for you is being equivalent to white men and you see yourself as being better than us. And so now we don't care. So that was just kind of like a shot at those white suffragettes who had gotten pretty racist after Black men got the vote before they did. Chapters 3 and 4 deal with education and progress. And these chapters are where Dr. Du Bois argues most vigorously against the Hampton and Tuskegee models. He does that in a lot of places, like in this era of his life. Like, you could ask him, can you pass the mustard? And he'd be like, the Hampton model fucking sucks. Dr. Du Bois is really good at what Shakespeare calls damning with faint praise. And he cements his petty status as one of the pettiest academics in U.S. history. Although Dr. Du Bois refers to the Atlanta Compromise as the most noble of Mr. Washington's career, like, what's the point of saying that if you're just going to turn around and be like, but it was some bullshit, though? Like, that's what damning with faint praise is. It's the stuff he does in this book. Dr. Du Bois immediately follows up that praise by saying that it was emblematic of the old attitude of adjustment and submission. So he's basically saying, like, you're a victim. That's basically like what W.E.B. Du Bois was saying to Booker T. Washington, like, every time he saw him. You look great, man, but you're a victim. Dr. Du Bois claimed that Washington wanted Black people to give up three things: political power, insistence on civil rights, and higher education. He feared that if Black people concentrate all their energies on industrial education, the accumulation of wealth, and the conciliation of the South. This would lead to, one, the disenfranchisement of the Negro. He was right there. Two, the legal creation of a distinct status of civil inferiority for the Negro. Correct again. And three, the steady withdrawal of aid from institutions for the higher training of the Negro. And correct again. By Washington focusing on common school and industrial training, he depreciates institutions of higher learning where teachers, professional men, and leaders are trained. He also states, but so far as Mr. Washington apologizes for injustice, North or South, does not rightly value the privilege and duty of voting, opposes the higher training and ambition of our brighter minds. So far as he, the South, or the nation does this, we must unceasingly and firmly oppose them. So this is like kind of rude because he's basically saying like, he's on the side of the people who are lynching us, basically. Now, by the time that Dr. Du Bois published The Souls of Black Folk in 1903, most of the former Confederate states had completed the disenfranchisement of African Americans through constitutional amendments and other laws that raise barriers to voter registration, primarily through poll taxes, residency and record-keeping requirements, subjective literacy tests, and other devices. These initiatives started in Mississippi, and by 1890, the rest of the South had followed. Virginia, Booker T. Washington's home state, passed similar laws by 1908. By excluding Blacks from political life, Southern legislators were able to pass Jim Crow laws and other discriminatory methods. So the remaining chapters of The Souls of Black Folk are titled Of the Meaning of Progress, about what it felt like for him to leave the all-Black enclave and community of Fisk University, and then return to see that progress or assimilation had infiltrated that space. Nothing is sadder than like when you just remember just having some good ass Black ass time somewhere and then you come back and it's like all Starbucks and weird dogs being walked and people wearing Tevas and it's just like, damn, niggas can't have nothing. That's basically what he was saying in Of the Meaning of Progress. And then the next chapter is Of the Wings of Atlanta, where Dr. Du Bois compares the city of Atlanta to the mythological figure Atalanta, who was under the protection of the hunter goddess Artemis and sailed with the Argonauts as the only woman among them. According to Ovid's Metamorphoses, Atalanta refused to marry unless a man could beat her in a foot race, which everyone knew was impossible because her feet were guided by the very swift Artemis. Instead, a man named Hippomenes, who was a son of Hermes, which is why he was so tricksy, he placed three golden apples along the racing path that were given to him by the love goddess Aphrodite. And Atalanta wound up losing the race because she stopped to pick up these golden apples. I figure she's a Libra. And Hippomenes was able to win the foot race and then Atalanta's hand in marriage, which caused her to lose the favor of the goddess Artemis because Artemis is a virgin goddess and never married. And she also lost her incredible strength and speed. Dr. Du Bois made this analogy, and I really wonder why he thought so many people would be familiar with the tale of Atalanta. But he made this analogy to warn the people of Atlanta, Black people of Atlanta, against the greed of gold or interpreting the world in dollars. The Black world beyond the veil should not succumb truth, beauty, and goodness, which is like the virtues of a quality education, to the idea of wealth attainment in public schools. He writes, beyond the veil are smaller, but like problems of ideals, of leaders, and the lead of serfdom, of poverty, of order and subordination, and through all the veil of race. He admonished readers to teach workers to work and teach thinkers to think. And he says the need of the South is knowledge and culture, which, yes and no. Speaking Latin and quoting Ovid aren't the only markers of culture. But again, this is late Victorian, early Edwardian era W.E.B. Du Bois, and we still have so much more enlightenment to go. As a means of segueing into his next chapter titled Of the Training of Black Men, Dr. Du Bois writes, and to make men, we must have ideals, broad, pure, and inspiring ends of living, not sordid money-getting, not apples of gold. Well, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, I am sorry to report that the city of Atlanta did not feel you on that advice. Of the training of Black men concerns itself with what else? The training of Black men. Dr. Du Bois was taken to task over his dismissive attitude towards the specific concerns of Black women, most notably by Ida B. Wells, and also later by his second wife, Shirley Graham. Although Dr. Du Bois made considerable points when he said that in order to lift Black people out of poverty, Black women should be better compensated. I'm going to be screaming this for the rest of my life, my very long life. In 1899, he told y'all, you want to solve Black poverty? Don't get married. Just get Black men more money. They already running all the households, whether a man's there or not. Just pay Black women more and we'll all be okay. Pay me more so that everybody can be great. I mean, I'm raising a little Black boy. It's going to help him too. He was right. He was right. He was right. We need to get paid more. He was right. But anyway, he still felt that Black men should be the leaders and the faces of their communities, and that the work of Black women was primarily to support them. So that's why he wanted us to make more money, so we could support y'all as you march through the streets in suits. I'm not feeling that one. At any rate, in this chapter, Dr. Du Bois again harps on the necessity of classical education and asserts education that encourages aspiration, that sets the loftiest of ideals and seeks as an end culture and character rather than breadwinning, is the right of the Black as well as the white. Okay. He goes on to state, if the Negro was to learn, he must teach himself. And cites the 30,000 Black teachers created in one generation who wiped out the illiteracy of the majority of Black people of the land, and they made Tuskegee possible. Which, that is a pretty large feat. Like, Black people, like the first generation out of slavery, really went hard to combat illiteracy. So where did we get the phrase, if you don't want a nigga to know something, put it in a book? Because we always been really, really big on reading. Ever since we could, and even before we could. I mean, if a slave was gonna break the rules, they was gonna break the rules to either get a little bit more food or to learn how to read. As a people, we're really, really big on reading. I don't know where that negative stereotype that where Black people don't like to read comes from, because that is a pretty big deal to go from something like 90% of all Black people in the United States being enslaved to a generation later, 30,000 Black teachers. And illiteracy was all but wiped out in one generation. Like, our ancestors was on their shit. Big ups to them. Additionally, 2,500 Black men had received a bachelor's degree, of whom 53% became teachers or leaders of educational systems. Again, this is like not even 50 years out of slavery. Not even 50 years out of slavery. And this is... these are the type of numbers we putting up on the board. It's not bad. It's not bad. 17% became clergymen. 17% mainly physicians. 6% merchants, farmers, and artisans. And 4% in government service. From 1875 to 1880, there were 22 Black male graduates from Northern colleges and 143 from Southern Negro colleges. From 1895 to 1900, Northern colleges graduated 100 Black men and over 500 graduated from Southern Negro colleges. Dr. Du Bois concludes by stating that the inevitable problems of civilization the Negro must meet and solve largely for himself. Now that, I feel that. The function of the Negro College, then, is clear. It must maintain the standards of popular education, it must seek the social regeneration of the Negro, and it must help in the solution of problems of race, contact, and cooperation. And finally, beyond all this, it must develop men. The remaining chapters are essays on the Black Belt, an area of former plantations where large concentrated Black populations are still found. Race contact, specifically as it relates to physical proximity, economic and political relations, intellectual contact, social contact, and religious enterprise, of which there was very little in the Black Belt. The Rise of the Black Church, where Dr. Du Bois examined the history and contemporary state of religion and spiritualism amongst African Americans and Black music, specifically Negro spirituals, as the articulate message of the slave to the world. The literary response to The Souls of Black Folk was tremendous, both at the time of its publishing and now. According to Dr. Manning Marable, Pulitzer Prize-winning professor of public affairs, history, and African-American studies at Columbia University and the author of W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Radical Democrat, what the hell kind of title is that? Few books make history and fewer still become foundational texts for the movements and struggles of an entire people. The Souls of Black Folk occupies this rare position. It helped to create the intellectual argument for the Black freedom struggle in the 20th century. Souls justified the pursuit of higher education for Negroes and thus contributed to the rise of the Black middle class. By describing a global color line, Dr. Du Bois anticipated Pan-Africanism and colonial revolutions in the Third World. Moreover, this stunning critique of how race is lived through the normal aspects of daily life is central to what will become known as whiteness studies a century later. When Souls of Black Folk was initially published, the Nashville Banner warned that this book is dangerous for the Negro to read, for it will only incite discontent and fill his imagination with things that do not exist or things that should not bear upon his mind. And the New York Times said, a review of the work of the Freedmen's Bureau from the Negro point of view, even the Northern Negro's point of view, must have its value to any unprejudiced student. Still more, perhaps, for the prejudiced who is yet willing to be a student. Dr. Hazel Carby offers a gendered perspective on the Souls of Black Folk as well. In her article titled Race Men, published in 1998, Dr. Carby traces the ways in which Dr. Du Bois gendered his narrative of Black life and how Dr. Du Bois' conceptual framework is gendered as well. According to Dr. Carby, in the Souls of Black Folk, Dr. Du Bois is most concerned with how race and nation intersect and concludes that these intersections are based on particularly masculine notions of progress. According to Dr. Carby, Dr. Du Bois exposes and exploits the tension that exists between the internal egalitarianism of the nation and the relations of domination and subordination embodied in a racially encoded social hierarchy. Essentially, what that means is, in Souls, Dr. Du Bois conceptualizes a racialized American nation state insofar as it creates races that are on equal footing socially and economically. So he's saying that that's feasible to have a racialized American nation state insofar as there is parity, autonomy, and, you know, there's a significant enough number of Black people that have what their contemporaries and whiteness have. So like, if they have 17 billionaires, we should have 17 billionaires. He's thinking of Blackness as a nation within a nation. And that we need to have these things for ourselves because, well, if we're waiting on anybody else, we're not going to have shit. Now, in referring to the soul and centering most of his essays around the lives of Black people in the Black Belt, Dr. Du Bois is conceptualizing a Black nation within a nation behind a veil that they're both grateful for and resentful of. However, this unified race is only made possible through the gendered narrative that he constructs, which renders Black male intellectuals like himself as the only possible leaders of this unified race. Dr. Carby explains that in order to retain his credentials for leadership, Dr. Du Bois had to situate himself as both an exceptional and representative individual. The terms and conditions of his exceptionalism, Dr. Du Bois argues, have their source in his formation as a gendered intellectual. Now, I would like to take a minute and just sit with that statement because while reading it, several other Black male figures came to mind, namely like President Barack Obama or Jay-Z or Will Smith, right? These men have also situated themselves as both exceptional for their achievements and their talents, but also representational as like models of Black manhood, whether that be politically savvy or commercially successful. This is the kind of Black man that you should want to be, but these are exceptional Black men. So it's kind of like a carrot stick kind of thing. It's like, if you're exceptional, then how can you also be aspirational? Like, exceptional can't be relatable. It's exceptional. Not everybody can do that. That's what makes you stand out. So that reminded me of the episode that I did on representational politics and repressive desublimation and how diversity in identity hasn't really produced valuable social change because the diversity is shallow. It's only in appearance, not in thought, and definitely not in practice. Like the NFL. The NFL brought in Jay-Z in the aftermath of the Kaepernick collusion scandal, and they use his black maleness and his exceptional black maleness, you know, because of his success, to rebrand themselves as a non-racist and inclusive organization. However, if Gruden's recent email scandal is any indication, Jay-Z's presence has had little to no impact on changing the culture of the NFL, nor of changing the opinion of people of the NFL, which is that it's run by a cabal of old racist white men and a few token billionaires of non-European descent who are also racist. According to Dr. Carby, Dr. Du Bois was concerned with the reproduction of race men, or the figure of the intellectual and race leader is born of and engendered by other males. Now, if you'll recall from last episode in the Philadelphia Negro study, Dr. Du Bois concluded that the submerged tenth, meaning the least educated and most inclined towards crime and moral laxity within the black population, were overrepresented in the media, which colored white perceptions of black people as a whole. His solution then was to create a strong, talented tenth of black men that would overshadow the submerged tenth and change these perceptions as well as lift up their communities. And if you go back to what I was talking about in the first chapter about like late Victorian and Edwardian attitudes around the globe, the idea of race men was pretty prevalent. Like I said, you know, the infusion of like capitalism into a lot of these older social structures created new wealth, right? And with these new wealth come these new men who a lot of times when they are doing business with Europeans, they feel a need to be both exceptional because they're doing something that previous generations in their family would not have been able to do under the pre-capitalist social order, but they're also representative and supposed to be aspirational. They're representing their entire ethnic group, their entire religion, their entire race. And so there was a lot of this whole like reproduction of race men talk. And W.E.B. Du Bois was at this point, this is 1903, he was very much a man of the times. But if you keep listening, he does tend to change with the times. Now, Dr. Carby was not the first person to make these assertions. In her 2003 autobiography, Ida B. Wells Barnett and American Reform, 1880-1930, author Patricia Schechter writes that Dr. Du Bois, who would eventually go on to found the NAACP with Ida B. Wells, frequently chastised her as too radical and would often remind her in subtle and not so subtle ways that her main objective should be to support his and other black men's work, not fight for her own spotlight. Schechter also writes that Booker T. Washington gave Wells Barnett similar advice. In a letter to Dr. Du Bois dated 30 May 1903, Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was at the time the chairman of the Anti-Lynching League and relied on the charitable donations of liberal white women of means to continue her work investigating lynchings, she wrote to Dr. Du Bois about her friends, Miss Celia Parker Woolley and Jane Addams of Hull House. She referred to them as friends of the race, and both women were known to donate funds to both Ida B. Wells Barnett and Dr. Du Bois. Both women had complained to Ida B. Wells Barnett that in Dr. Du Bois' exhaustive list of acknowledgments, they had been excluded and their feelings were hurt, which was to say the money might dry up as a result. So Ida B. Wells is like, damn, don't fuck up the money for both of us. So she had to reassure the women that, oh, he didn't mean it. And he told me that he was super duper grateful for you guys and da 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 da. Because, you know, his apparent snubbing could have hurt her resources too. Ida B. Wells Barnett ensures Dr. Du Bois in this letter that she smoothed things over with both women, thereby continuing the stream of donations to both of them. But she also subtly reminds him that the contributions of women to his work should not be so easily forgotten. Dr. Du Bois, who had gained a reputation at Atlanta University for being kind of aloof and distant, he was also known to be a flatterer when it was necessary and was able to make anyone feel like they were the most important person in the world and that they were super critical to the work that he was going to do and that their donations, their help, their resources were going to do a world of good. And who doesn't like to hear that, you know, by giving this money to this guy, I'm going to be helping out the whole Negro race. So once the funds were secured, though, or, you know, the female assistant had finished doing the bulk of the surveys, as was the case in the Philadelphia Negro, Dr. Du Bois might scarcely acknowledge that the person he had once deemed so important and critical even existed. And usually these discarded people were female. Chapter 5, The Niagara Movement, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and the Crisis. In 1905, Dr. Du Bois and several other African-American civil rights activists, including Frederick L. McGee, Jesse Max Barber, and William Monroe Trotter, met in Niagara Falls, Canada, where they wrote a Declaration of Principles opposing the Atlanta Compromise. These principles were then incorporated as part of the Niagara Movement in 1906. The Atlanta Compromise happened in what, like 1896, 1897? And you're like still on this? Damn, dog. Since most of the Black-owned newspapers at the time were run by publishers sympathetic to Booker T. Washington, Dr. Du Bois bought a printing press and began publishing the Moon Illustrated Weekly by December of 1905. It was the first African-American illustrated weekly, and Dr. Du Bois mainly used it to attack Washington's positions, but the magazine lasted only for about 8 months. Undeterred, Dr. Du Bois soon founded and edited another vehicle for his polemics against the Atlanta Compromise, which was called the Horizon, a Journal of the Color Line, which debuted in 1907. The Niagarites held a second conference in August 1906, in celebration of the 100th anniversary of abolitionist John Brown's birth at the site of the raid on Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. Reverdy C. Ransom spoke, explaining that Washington's primary goal was to prepare Blacks for employment in their current society. Today, two classes of Negroes are standing at the parting of the ways. One counsels patient submission to our present humiliations and degradations. The other class believe that it should not submit to being humiliated, degraded, and remanded to an inferior place. It does not believe in bartering its manhood for the sake of gain. Now, prior to the fall of 1906, Booker T. Washington's ideas were far more popular with African Americans and white Americans than W.E.B. Du Bois' ideas. Dr. Du Bois was seen around this time as an uppity, high yellow Negro with a weird New England accent who took himself way too seriously and was overdressed most of the time. Booker T. Washington was also light-skinned and had light eyes as well, and he was also kind of a dandy, like they used to try to like outdress each other. But he postured himself as the more humble of the two men, and while Dr. Du Bois would not hesitate to publicly attack Booker T. Washington's stances, Booker T. Washington rarely reciprocated in kind publicly. And he was always gracious publicly when he was asked about Dr. Du Bois. Privately, though, he gave it as good as he got it. And he often resorted to ad hominem attacks on Dr. Du Bois' mixed ethnic heritage, which he knew hurt Dr. Du Bois very deeply because he considered himself a Black man. He didn't really consider himself as being mixed race and all that and all that stuff, despite that the fact that he had really recent European heritage, mostly French. He thought of himself as, no, I'm a Black man. I'm viewed as a Black man. All I care about is the Black race. And he didn't like having, you know, his heritage or his skin color or his hair type or any of that stuff used against him because he really didn't see himself as being different from or better than any other Black person in the world. He cared very deeply about his people. And so because both men were light-skinned and had European heritage, I mean, Booker T. Washington's father was his master. Because both of these men were like of the same complexion and all that, you know, they would talk about it privately. But then to other people, usually people in his camp, Booker T. Washington would use what Dr. Du Bois told him in confidence, like to mock him and make fun of him and stuff. And then his acolytes would also do it. And then Dr. Du Bois' acolytes would attack them. And it would just turn into like that scene from School Days where they're just like, "You're just a jigaboo." Like some of the things that these people used to say about each other was like, damn. And even Marcus Garvey later on even gets Dr. Du Bois to resort to like colorism. And he was like really against that. He's like, we shouldn't call each other like, you know, making fun of each other's features for being more Africanized. But when it came to Marcus Garvey, he did not care about none of that shit. He called him nigger lips. I mean, Marcus Garvey used to call him like white man spit. It's kind of funny, but it's not. But despite, you know, their backbiting, frenemy type ways, their ideological feud was always more so between their acolytes than the two men themselves. The two men themselves were too bougie to get down in the mud and like attack each other in anything less than a principled way. But their acolytes sometimes just did not care. Now, the tide turned against the accommodationist stance of Booker T. Washington and his Atlanta Compromise in 1906 when two things happened. First, President Theodore Roosevelt dishonorably discharged 167 black soldiers because they had been accused, framed, for crimes as a result of the Brownsville Affair. The Brownsville Affair, or the Brownsville Raid, was an incident where the white residents of Brownsville, Texas, raided the barracks of the Buffalo soldiers, black soldiers who were part of a segregated union unit stationed at nearby Fort Brown. Their pretense for the raid was that a white bartender was killed and a white police officer was wounded in a gunfight on the same night. Plot twist, they did it to each other. They were fighting each other. Although witnesses said that not only were the two men not shot by black men, they hadn't seen any black men in town the entire night because Brownsville, Texas was a well-known sundown town. As in, if you're not white, you need to be out of here by sundown. The Buffalo soldiers all had curfews that were much earlier than their white counterparts as well, and white commanding officers who patrolled the barracks on rotating shifts to make sure that they didn't leave those barracks after curfew. Despite all of this, the white residents raided their barracks and planted evidence against these black soldiers. The incident and President Roosevelt's response to it left a bad taste in many mouths, both black and white. White military personnel felt like it was going to hurt recruiting efforts, and they needed black soldiers because, well, America was starting its first forays into imperialism in Cuba and Haiti and the Philippines, and was also still, you know, committing genocide against Native Americans in the plains and the West Coast. African Americans saw the Brownsville Affair and President Roosevelt's response to it as just more evidence of white people changing the rules to suit themselves, which kind of makes assimilation useless. Like, if every single time I try to just get along, fit in, you just change the rules and make me the bad guy each and every time, well, why bother? Now, to add insult to injury, many of the discharged soldiers had served for 20 years, mostly on the front lines of the Indian Wars, and they were due to retire and receive a pension that would have helped them to live comfortably. But when they were dishonorably discharged, all of that was taken from them. The second incident occurred in September of 1906 when a race riot erupted in Atlanta, Georgia. Using the old protect Southern white womanhood excuse, 10,000 white people descended on Atlanta's black neighborhoods, beating and in some cases murdering every black person they could find, man, woman, or child. The actual reason for the race riot was that black steel workers in Atlanta's Mechanicsville neighborhood were attempting to unionize and made the mistake of inviting some of their white co-workers to join them. At the time, many employers were hiring black workers over white ones because the black workers would accept less pay. So the workplace was already kind of tense. In the aftermath of the 1906 violence, Dr. Du Bois urged black people to withdraw their support from the Republican Party because Republicans, Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, did not sufficiently support black rights. This was a radical call at the time because African Americans had loyally voted Republican since they gained the right to vote in the 1860s. You know, that Party of Lincoln stuff. Dr. Du Bois wrote an essay titled A Litany at Atlanta, which asserted that the Atlanta race riot of 1906 was proof that the Atlanta Compromise was a failure. He noted that despite Black people holding up their end of the bargain, white Southerners had not held up theirs, nor had white Northerners protected Black people in the South. Historian David Levering Lewis wrote that the Atlanta Compromise was no longer useful because the old guard white patrician planter class, who had a more paternalistic view of Black people from the antebellum days, kind of like, oh, Sambo, he's just so dumb. You know, we gotta look after the Negroes. These people had been replaced by aggressive businessmen who were usually carpetbaggers from the North or the Midwest, or they were recent immigrants from Europe. And they were willing to pit Black workers against white ones to prevent solidarity movements. So you got to sprinkle in a little bit of anti-communism in there too, and it just causes a pot of cake to erupt. In May 1909, Dr. Du Bois attended the National Negro Conference in New York. While there, the National Negro Committee was founded, chaired by Oswald Villard. And it was, why was it chaired by a white guy? Anyway, and it was dedicated to the causes of civil rights, voting rights, and equal educational opportunities. The following spring in 1910, at the second National Negro Conference, like, Negroes in the name, and you let a white guy be the chair. Or maybe he wasn't white, he just looked like it. Because, you know, that was a thing. The attendees at the second National Negro Conference created the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or NAACP. Ever the Pan-Africanist, Dr. Du Bois had insisted that the word colored be used rather than black, as it was meant to include dark-skinned people everywhere. Dozens of civil rights activists and supporters, both black and white, participated in the founding of the NAACP, but most of the executive officers were white, including Mary Ovington, Charles Edward Russell, William English Walling, and its first president, Moorfield Story. Later in the 1940s, during the Stop India movement against British colonization, the Indian social reformer and civil rights activist Dr. Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar was inspired by Dr. Du Bois' use of colored to include all dark-skinned people of the world and wrote to Dr. Du Bois in 1946, introducing himself as a member of the Untouchables of India, also known as Dalits. Dalit is a name for people who used to belong to the lowest caste in India, and they were previously characterized as untouchables. Untouchables were excluded from the fourfold Varna system of Hinduism and were seen as Avarna, also known by the name of Panchama. According to B.R. Ambedkar, untouchability came into Indian society around 400 CE during a power struggle between Buddhism and Brahmanical Hinduism. Brahmanical Hinduism developed during the Vedic period of Indian history, and it's one of the major traditions that shaped Hinduism, though present-day Hinduism is markedly different from the historical Vedic religion. During this time, the Vedic period, some Hindu priests befriended untouchables and were demoted to low caste ranks. B.R. Ambedkar is commonly thought of as popularizing and politicizing the term Dalit, which in Sanskrit means divided, split, broken, or scattered, to encompass all those who were oppressed due to low caste and covered all those who were excluded from the fourfold Varna system of Hinduism. So that would include not only untouchable Hindus, but like Christians, Muslims, Jains, Buddhists, atheists, anybody in India who wasn't part of the fourfold Varna system, basically. In his letter, B.R. Ambedkar wrote that he was a student of the Negro problem and expressed his interest in the NAACP's petition to the UN. He noted that his group was thinking of following suit and requested copies of the proposed statement from Dr. Du Bois, which he received a little while later. In a letter dated 31 July 1946, Dr. Du Bois responded by telling Ambedkar that he was familiar with his name and that he had every sympathy with the Untouchables of India. Dr. Ambedkar went on to become British India's Minister of Labor and Viceroy's Executive Council, Chairman of the Constituent Drafting Committee, independent India's first minister of law and justice, and he is considered the chief architect of the Constitution of India. His later life was marked by his political activities. He became involved in campaigning and negotiations for India's independence, published journals, advocated political rights and social freedom for Dalits, and contributed significantly to the establishment of the state of India. In 1956, he converted to Buddhism, which initiated a mass conversion of Dalits, which initiated a major shift in a lot of the rhetoric and ways that Hinduism was practiced. Dr. Du Bois immediately got to work within the NAACP, using his influential position within the organization to bring awareness to racist incidents in America. In 1915, when the silent film Birth of a Nation premiered, Dr. Du Bois and the NAACP led the fight to have the movie banned due to its racist depictions of Black men as lustful brutes who raped white women. Now, mind you, it seems like what a bunch of do about nothing, but at this time, rape was the number one pretense that white people would use to like go on night rides and scourge Black neighborhoods and round up Black men and sell them on chain gangs or worse. So I can see why in 1915, Dr. Du Bois and the NAACP would not want anything to propagate that myth and put even more Black men in danger. Because there was a couple of incidents where after seeing Birth of a Nation in theaters, white people went and got their pitchforks and their stakes and stuff, and they just went ham on some poor Black people who weren't doing nothing to nobody. Now, they were unsuccessful in having the movie banned, and President Woodrow Wilson even screened the film in the White House. But the publicity did bring many new supporters, a lot of them from outside the United States, to the NAACP. The NAACP also fought Woodrow Wilson on a number of other matters. In 1914, many federal agencies adopted whites-only employment practices, doubling the unemployment rate amongst Black people in Washington, D.C. and the surrounding areas overnight. The Army excluded Black men from the officer ranks, and the Immigration Service prohibited the immigration of persons of African ancestry wholesale. Dr. Du Bois wrote an editorial in 1914 deploring the dismissal of Blacks from federal posts, and he supported William Monroe Trotter when Trotter brusquely confronted President Wilson about the president's failure to fulfill his campaign promise of social justice for Black people. The newspaper of the NAACP, called The Crisis, continued to wage a campaign against lynching. This anti-lynching investigative work had begun in the 1890s by Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was also a founding member of the NAACP, although Dr. Du Bois excluded her name as a founding member in his biography, Dark Water, Voices from Beyond the Veil. Indeed, Ida B. Wells Barnett and other Black women, such as Mary Burnett Talbert and Angelina Grimke, Mary Burnett Talbert was Black, but Angelina Grimke was the white aunt of Archibald Grimke. And they were at the forefront of the anti-lynching movement. After the lynchings of three of her friends, Ida B. Wells Barnett condemned the lynchings in her newspapers, Free Speech, and Headlight. Ida B. Wells Barnett used investigative journalism to reveal the abuse and racial violence African Americans were going through, and she encouraged Black women to work for anti-lynching laws to be passed. She was also part of the first suffrage club for Black women. In a circular titled The Shame of America, Ida B. Wells asked, is rape the cause of lynching? And exposed that many of the lynchings used the pretext of white women being raped by Black men when it was rarely, if ever, the case. She also championed the Dyer anti-lynching bill. Because of her anti-lynching campaigning, she received death threats from racist rioters. And after having her children, she left most of the anti-lynching organizations, but she continued to protest lynching, including the Sam Holmes lynching in Georgia. In 1915, The Crisis published an article with a year-by-year tabulation of 2,732 lynchings from 1884 to 1914. The April 1916 edition featured the group lynching of six African Americans in Lee County, Georgia. And in 1916, the Waco Horror article covered the lynching of Jesse Washington, a mentally impaired 17-year-old African American boy. The article broke new ground by utilizing undercover reporting to expose the conduct of local whites in Waco, Texas. Chapter 6, The Status of the Negro on the Eve of the First World War. The United States entered the First World War on the side of the British and French forces in 1917. After the totally not staged sinking of the passenger ship Lusitania, which was carrying, as most passenger liners do, rich people who wanted to visit Europe during a war and secret weapons that the United States had sworn that they would not sell to the British or the French. As the United States prepared to enter World War I, Joel Springarn, Dr. Du Bois' colleague in the NAACP, established a camp to train African Americans to serve as officers in the U.S. military. The camp was controversial because some whites felt that Black people were not qualified to be officers, and also because some Black people rightly felt that African Americans should not participate in what they considered a white man's war. Springarn's camp came in the aftermath of the Houston race riot of 1917. The riot began after Houston police arrested and beat two Black soldiers, and in response, over 100 Black soldiers took to the streets of Houston and killed 16 whites. A military court-martial was held, and 19 of the soldiers were hanged, and 67 others were in prison. In spite of the Houston riot, Dr. Du Bois and others successfully pressed the Army to accept the officers trained at Spring Gardens Camp, resulting in over 600 Black officers joining the Army in October 1917. Dr. Du Bois supported Springarn's training camp, but he was disappointed when the Army forcibly retired one of its few Black officers, Charles Young, on the pretense of ill health. The Army agreed to create 1,000 officer positions for Black men, but insisted that 250 come from the enlisted ranks because they were conditioned to taking orders from white men rather than from independent-minded Black male officers who came from the Springarn camp. Over 700,000 Black men enlisted on the first day of the draft, but they were subjected to discriminatory conditions, which prompted vocal protests from Dr. Du Bois. Yeah, duh. They told you that was going to happen. I would have just sat my ass down. I ain't got nothing to do with France. In 1917, Dr. Du Bois organized the Silent Parade in New York to protest the East St. Louis riots. The East St. Louis riots was a series of race riots in the summer of 1917 when white Americans murdered between 39 and 150 African Americans in late May and early July. Oh, that should say June of 1917. In the aftermath of the race riots, another 6,000 Black people in East St. Louis were left homeless, and the burning and vandalism cost approximately $400,000, which is about $8,080,000 in adjusted for inflation. And property damage. The multi-day riot has been described as the worst case of labor-related violence in 20th century American history, and among the worst racial riots in U.S. history. In the aftermath, the East St. Louis Chamber of Commerce called for the resignation of the local police chief because officers were told not to shoot white rioters and were unwilling to suppress the violence and destruction. A number of Black people left the city permanently. Black enrollment in public schools in the era dropped by 35% by the time schools reopened that fall. After the East St. Louis riots, Dr. Du Bois traveled to St. Louis to report on the aftermath and the government response. Dr. Du Bois' reporting resulted in an article titled The Massacre of East St. Louis, which was published in the September issue of The Crisis, and it contained photographs and interviews detailing the violence. David Levering Lewis concluded that Dr. Du Bois distorted some of the facts of the riot in order to increase the propaganda value of the article. Dr. Du Bois also organized a silent parade in New York City, a march of around 9,000 African Americans down Fifth Avenue, to demonstrate the Black community's outrage over the riots. Next episode, W.E.B. Du Bois travels back to Europe to attend the first Pan-African Congress, not to be confused with the Pan-African Conference, interviews Black soldiers returning from World War I about their experiences, and mingles with the Black elite during the Harlem Renaissance, a time when the Negro was in vogue. This period of his life resulted in the title of the next episode, The Gift of Black Folk. The Negroes in the Making of America, his 1924 book that detailed the role of African Americans in American history, taking part in the earliest explorations of the North American continent, founding cities, and inventing everything from ice cream to player pianos. In The Gift of Black Folk, Dr. Du Bois argues that Black people have been essential to the creation of the United States and that our presence in America has been a gift to this country that we're not properly appreciated for. He also begins flirting with socialism around this time in his life, and he continues to advocate for Pan-Africanism. Join me next time for more Musings on History.